This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 287 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me this episode is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, Max.
How's it going?
Good. Lovely weekend. Lovely holiday weekend we had here in the States. So relaxed. Not as tan as our co-host, but relaxed and ready for a good show tonight.
Well, you know, I was going to bring up that tanning aspect. Also joining us is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog, who may be the most tanned airplane geek, at least in this hemisphere these days. Hi, Rob.
Hi, guys. And you know what? I had my, in honor of our guest tonight, I had my red Speedo on when I was down in San Juan. And, and so there are parts that are just, you know, but we'll, you know, we'll take that part out of the show for those, because this is a family show. Or at least we're trying. But I just have to make one point. 33 days. You know what happens in 33 days?
I hope it's something good. Is it something warm?
It's the beginning of spring.
All right. Can't
but
wait.
But who's counting?
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Mary Kirby. Now, Mary's one of the airline industry's most knowledgeable and well-respected experts on the passenger experience. And it's always a pleasure to welcome her to the Airplane Geeks podcast. So, Mary, great to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, your new project, the Runway Girl Network, it really looks like it's a big hit right out of the box.
We are cooking with gas.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm really pleased to have a little tiny part in that. But for any of our listeners who haven't seen it yet, maybe you can describe what the network is.
Okay, absolutely. Well, we describe it as where air transport intelligence meets the passenger experience. And what we're trying to do is write about intelligence, about this part of the industry that really touches every passenger. So that is aircraft interiors, IFEC, airport services, loyalty, social media, you name it, we're covering it with the passenger experience. And I'm doing it with a cadre of fantastic female aviation journalists.
Very cool. It's great content, and we're going to talk about that soon. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the aviation news from the past week first. And also coming up, David, do we have a history segment?
We do, and it actually is a history segment this week. I'd like to thank our buddy Henry Hartevelt for inspiring it by sending one of his tweets out this weekend from the AvGeek Fest out in Washington State. We're going to talk about the Boeing aircraft that created the DC-3. That would be the Boeing 247.
Yeah, very good. Okay. Can't wait for that. We also have an Australia Desk report. The Boys Down Under talk with Mike Yeo from the Base Leg blog about his trip to the Singapore Air Show. And so we'll look for that. Also, we have no Across the Pond segment. Peter Johnson's taking the week off, so we won't have that this time. And then we'll talk about some of the listener mail we received. Particularly, we got a lot of feedback after last episode's conversation about aviation museums. Quite a few listeners sent in their favorite aviation museums, and so we'll touch on those. First, though, let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Yep. Ready.
First off, let's talk about the just concluded Singapore Air Show. And this seems to be kind of a success. At least it's been reported that way. We saw orders of about $32 billion at List, of course, always at List, from the air show. A few interesting orders. We saw Indonesian Regional Air Costa place an order for 50 firm and 50 option Embraer E-jets. These are the new Embraer jets with the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine. Rob, this is probably a pretty good order for Embraer, wouldn't you say?
Oh, I think these days any order for any of these aircraft at the shows is always a great result when you're at the show. And I think that for Embraer, for Boeing, for Airbus, the show has been, again, a good one. But there is that one company that didn't seem to quite place at the show that everybody's been wondering about.
And you're referring to?
Yeah, to the Bombardier folks with their C-Series. I mean, I know they have the order from the Chinese that they say, but, you know, still, I don't know what it is about that airplane. I mean, people just don't. You see the numbers, but for some reason, people just don't seem to have that wow, that confidence that this whole thing's going to come together. Even when they see the numbers, like these, the Chinese leasing company took on at the show.
Yeah, CLC, that Chinese leasing company, I think they ordered up to 30 Bombardier C-Series, which that represents, I believe, the first order in China for that aircraft. But yeah, it's not kicking into high gear the way that, well, at least many of us would hope that we would see. But at least there's some movement there.
There is activity, yes.
There is some activity.
But as I know, I had dinner with a friend of mine from Embraer the other night, and of course they were jumping up and down about more orders at the Singapore show. So that's a good thing.
We also saw some activity from NOC Air, N-O-C. It's a budget airline in Thailand. They ordered some 737s, 15 737s. But maybe even overshadowing that, I think, in some ways, is some of the comments that the CEO of NOC made about women. And Mary, you wrote about this, I think, didn't you?
I did. I was pretty stunned, actually, to read Flight Global journalist Gimle Yeo's comments on social media about attending this press briefing. It was pretty stunning what the CEO of NOC Air was saying at the press briefing. And Gimle, who we're actually going to have on the PaxX podcast here later this week to kind of go into more detail, but she relayed via Twitter what this CEO said. And I think people would be kind of stunned to realize that this level of ageism and sexism is still going on in the industry in 2014.
It really was kind of shocking. I think as I commented over at the Runway Girl Network on that article, I think I thought all of those kinds of guys had died out by now.
Yeah.
But apparently that's not the case. And some people just have views that are, well, not as advanced as we would like to hope. Some of it may be cultural, but still,
Us what it was about, since I didn't see it?
So let me. I can read you a couple tweets. So this is verbatim what Gimle tweeted. NOC Air CEO Saracen, his name is Pate Saracen, says a lot of press in the room. Good that the airline brought along women, the flight attendants. He was flanked by two female flight attendants. Then he said it was good the airline was bringing Wi-Fi so passengers could use Facebook to show that the airline's female flight attendants are not old. And then he uncomfortable moment during the event was he was asked to take a picture with Boeing sales chief John Wojcik. And he goes over for the picture and yells, "Bring on the women!" It's kind of jarring. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you know, that there's that kind of budget carrier, Michael O'Leary type of, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say.
But at the same token, when you have female journalists, aviation journalists covering this industry, you know, that are part and party to, you know, have to deal with this, you realize it's time to change, and it's time for these CEOs, these male CEOs, to get their act together. And it's actually time for more female CEOs. And one of the great things, and I just want to mention, because I know you guys are going to talk about it, is this Vietjet Air. This is this Vietnamese budget carrier that ordered A320s. You know, it's quite fascinating. Their CEO is a woman, and we're actually going to write about her. We have got a great picture of her signing at the signing ceremony for CFM engines at the Singapore Air Show, and we have got a great picture of her. And it's the contrast of kind of this caddish, childish, knock-air CEO and this poised, classy woman. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, quite a contrast. That's good. Yeah. I'm glad we had that, or we see that kind of counterbalance to CEO at Knock Air.
I do too. There's so few C-level female executives, so
for sure.
How new is that? Is Vietjet Air? Is that, I mean, right in the startup phase? Because I had not heard of them before.
I have to be candid. I had not heard of them either until Aaron Karp. He is a senior editor at ATW. Alerted me to the fact that she was there and signed this order. So I need to do my homework as well about Vietjet Air. I want to pronounce her name correctly, but I know I will butcher it. And I believe it's Nguyen Thai Phuong Thao. Apologies if that is way off, but I need to do some homework on this airline. It sounds pretty interesting.
Yes, I think it is very new. It was a big order too. I think 63.
Yeah, that's A320s. What I was going to say. I mean, for a startup, I mean, that no one's heard of. I mean, 63 airplanes is no small order.
Also at Singapore, David, we saw that there were two Boeing or Bell Boeing V-22 Ospreys that made an appearance at the show. And I understand they came down from Japan. I think these were these Marine Ospreys.
Yeah, they were the CV-22s, which are the Marine versions. And Bell Boeing wants their – eventually the U.S. orders are going to dry up, and they're really looking forward to exporting them beyond just the Israeli Air Force. So this was a big show and opening up the gates and some realistic interest in the tiltrotor in an area where it's not had many fans, especially coming from Japan, where there's been a lot of issues with basing them there. No firm orders yet, but it's not like the civilian world where you can get pre-plan it and get it announced. In this case, it's got to be approved by the Pentagon, etc.
Sure,
but we might see them exported into the area of plane crazy down under. They'll get V-22s more. Singapore definitely is interested for maritime surveillance and. It's an interesting that we're now in a point where we're trying to sell them to the world, whereas, you know, 5 years ago you'd say that no one in their right mind was going to buy them besides the United States who invested in them. So good deal for Bell and Boeing.
When those Ospreys were originally moved to Japan, I remember that we talked about some of the local Japanese being very concerned about the operation of the V-22s there, from a safety standpoint. Has that pretty much blown away, blown over, I guess I should say? Have there been no real incidents, no causes for concern?
Knock on wood, nothing's happened yet. And what's an interesting turn of events is Japan is actually thinking maybe for its new, I guess you would call it a baby flat top. They don't want to call it an aircraft carrier, but suddenly, they want to put F-35Bs, the vertical takeoff version, on it, but they're also looking at V-22s. So maybe our Marines have turned the impression around for the Japanese on the Osprey.
All right. Also, pertaining to the air show in Singapore, we saw an article in Aviation Week, CFMI, telling COMAC needs more experienced management, which is, I think that's kind of interesting. CFM International is the partnership, the joint venture between GE Aviation and SNECMA, and they produce the CFM 56 engines, they are an option on the A320 family. They power the A340. And, of course, they have an exclusive on the Boeing 737. And the International Executive Vice President told COMAC, the Commercial Aircraft Corporation of China, that they need more experienced program management on the C919 aircraft. That's the 150-seat aircraft that COMAC is developing. The first flight of that has slipped from this year to 2015, and CFM is the engine on that aircraft. CFM says that despite the shifting in the first flight, they're not going to change the test schedule for the engine. These are the LEAP engines, so this is kind of CFM's answer to the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan engine, designed or will be designed to have roughly the same kind of fuel burn and some other important features. The just really quickly, there's the LEAP 1A, 1B, and 1C. The 1A engine is the engine that's an option on the Airbus A320neo. The LEAP 1B is the engine for the Boeing 737 MAX, and the LEAP 1C is the power plant for this COMAC C919. Now, when they say they're not going to change the test schedule for the LEAP 1C engine, I'm suspecting that's probably because the 1C is the first LEAP engine to be tested on a flying test bed. And so in order to develop and execute their test program, they have to get started, and they're supposed to start with the 1C, so despite COMAC's slippage. But I think this is kind of interesting. I don't think it was a comment made maliciously or anything. The CFMI says they have a good relationship with COMAC, but I thought it was interesting that they would offer this advice that they need to kind of work on their program management and make sure they get their supplier base established properly. We'll see what happens with the COMAC, with the C919, and whether it stays on its current schedule or slips more. And I don't know. We've certainly seen a lot of slippage from new aircraft, haven't we, guys?
Yeah.
I guess we should aspire to see an airplane take off on time.
It just doesn't seem to happen too often with new aircraft.
Though I'll give it to the Scorpion, the Bell Textron new little jet.
Mm.
They launched before everybody realized they were building one. So I got to give there. That's the exception that makes the rule, I guess.
That's right. All right. Well, there certainly is a lot more activity that came out of the Singapore show. We'll put some links in the show notes to some of the resources you can explore on your own. But why don't we move on and talk about Alaska Airlines? This was kind of an interesting story in CNBC. When Horizon Air starts flying the Bombardier Q400 between Anchorage and Fairbanks and between Anchorage and Kodiak on March 3rd, they're going to offer complimentary beer. It's called Old 55 Pale Ale. It's an Alaskan-made microbrew. Free beer on the flight. Do you think this is a good way to attract customers?
As long as it's good beer.
Well, my guess is that David is right, but however, I don't think people are going to be running between, I'm sure, where was it? Between where and Kodiak?
Anchorage and Kodiak.
Between Anchorage and Kodiak. I doubt people are going to jump on the airplane between Anchorage and Kodiak just to get a free beer. But
you don't know Alaskans then, do you?
Well, maybe you might be right. Yes, you might be right.
Mary, what's the state of in-flight amenities these days? Are we seeing changes or trends? Or are we ever going to see real meals come back onto flights, do you think?
You know, it's really interesting. Some carriers are making a very big effort in the in-flight meal arena. Obviously, premium is accustomed to getting all the bells and whistles. But I recently visited LSG in Germany, and it's interesting. These European carriers, even the low-cost carriers, are doing very creative buy-on-board meals. And LSG is creating these kind of very unique programs that get passengers excited about their flight. And some of the programs are actually based around alcohol. So they'll do kind of special cocktails. If you fly, say, for example, a Friday, they have like a Friday happy hour. And I'm trying to think which airline is it. Is it German Wings that does it? But I just thought it was very interesting. MSG was saying that, yes, some of these European carriers were testing some interesting programs. So then when I saw this story about the beer, I thought, you know, maybe we've got some U.S. carriers that are looking across the pond and saying, you know, we got to try and get a bit creative here about the passenger experience. Because at the end of the day, a lot of these aircraft are starting to look the same in flight. Slimline seats, packed together pretty tightly. And what do you do to differentiate the service? And what some airlines are finding is that it's the, quote, little touches that make the flight memorable. So I say props to Horizon for this effort. I do think you'd want to have a cutoff with that free beer.
I think that'd be a good idea.
So it's not a big deal. But we are seeing also at the same time an increase in air rage incidences, and there's some concerns that people drinking too much combined with the tensions of being at the airport and being in tight seating is leading to some issues in flight as well. So
a bad mix.
Yeah.
And I don't know what kind of deal they've worked with the microbrewery. I mean, the brewery may be subsidizing this in part so that it doesn't cost the airline all that much. I mean, this certainly gets some publicity for the micro brew for Old 55 Pale Ale. So maybe they're subsidizing it and it doesn't cost Horizon that much money. I don't know.
So let's think about some important pairing here, like Wisconsin Air selling Leinenkugels.
Not cheese, huh?
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, lots of possibilities.
I mean, United, well, any hard beverage to survive the flight. I don't, right, Rob?
Southwest,
you could use a lot of the Texas microbrews.
Who knows? They may be doing that.
Yeah, maybe we'll start to see a lot of this, a lot of brew flowing on board.
But, you know, as long as you're mentioning amenities, I came back from San Juan yesterday. I was on JetBlue, and I haven't flown them in years and years. They just happen to have a direct flight from O'Hare to San Juan, And so when I was on the way back, we were just looking in the back pocket at what was available. I was trying to find a beer to drink. And lo and behold, they have this whole cafe arrangement of very fresh-looking little meals that they offer for sale. And, of course, I'm not even going to be silly enough to expect it for free. But I actually got excited. And then they said, oh, you know what? We don't have it on the leg from San Juan to O'Hare. Mm. It's only available out of JFK to Los Angeles and Long Beach. And I thought, oh, what a crime. I mean, you get me all worked up and then you let me down.
Oh, dear. All right, let's push ahead to an item. We have another list. Now, we had a list last week on that was aviation museums, the best aviation museums. We have another list this week, not because we're going to have a list every week, but this one came up and it's kind of interesting. It's from news.com and it's Plane Crashes That Changed Aviation Forever. And it goes, let's see, I think this goes all the way back to 1956, where it talks about a TWA jet and a United Airlines flight that collided in midair, killing, this was over the Grand Canyon, all 128 people were killed. But this accident led to a revamp of the U.S. air traffic control system, and I guess maybe played a part in the creation 2 years later of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. So that was kind of interesting. And there's a number of accidents that had some kind of ongoing important consequences. Rob, are there a couple in here that you kind of found to be interesting or particularly significant?
Well, I actually, a listener somewhere sent me this. I wish I could remember who it was, but being very old, of course, everyone just has to give me a break because I don't remember. But thank you for sending it, whoever you were. But I, actually, if someone is new to the aviation industry and is trying to get a feel for how some of the technology that is used aboard aircraft today came to be, this list is perfect because you will, and it, of course, I should say it's not just the technology, but just say some of the procedures that we use. The 1978 United DC-8 that ran out of gas approaching Portland, and how that became the the basis for crew resource management, because the other members of the crew didn't speak up, even though they knew the thing was running out of gas, because they were scared to death of the captain. The Air Canada flight in which somebody was smoking in the lav and started a fire, and the airplane made it down in one piece. A bit of one piece down into Cincinnati. A bunch of people died. Of course, there were no smoke detectors in the labs or right, automatic fire extinguishers before that. There's the one where Piper Cherokee, it was an Arrow and a DC-9 collided going into LAX that gave us better collision avoidance systems. And there are those pictures of some of the aircraft, I think a 7-3 and a 7-4, in which some of the skin peeled off in flight, unbelievable bits and pieces of things that have happened in history that have caused changes within the system. But one thing I just want to make a real quick point of is that the list ends in 1998, and I think that's probably one of the more impressive parts of that, because what you begin to see is that by, say, 2000, roughly, we solved an awful lot of problems with things that didn't work well and how people didn't work well in the industry. Of course, now we're still dealing with the complexities of technology and pilots not paying attention or not, you know, having the proficiency they should when the technology fails. I mean, that's, and losing control of the airplane. I mean, loss of control is right now still the biggest problem we're facing, even though we haven't seen a ton of it here in the States, a little bit of it. Asiana, and it looks like possibly the UPS crash last year. It's really a great resource I found of how we kind of got to where we are right now. And if the person who sent this to me wants to send me an email and say it was me, I will acknowledge you next week with my apologies.
Coincidentally, we received a brief audio message from Ray that also relates to, in this case, I think a particular aviation accident. And so while we're talking this topic, maybe we'll just play real quick this message that Ray sent along. It's kind of interesting. So here's Ray.
Hi, guys. This is Ray Williams from Alpharetta, Georgia, with a little bit of trivia for you. On the 14th of January, 1936, around about 7:30 in the evening, a Douglas DC-2 aircraft, NC-14274, belonging to American Airlines, crashed near Goodwin in Arkansas. The aircraft was flying from Memphis to Little Rock, and there'd been no indication of any abnormality in the flight. However, it was cruising at low altitude, and in the darkness it hit the treetops and crashed into a swampy area about 4 miles from Goodwin. There was no fire either before or after the crash. However, when the press arrived and somebody used a flash camera, the flash ignited the gasoline on the ground and a substantial fire ensued. Because of this fire, and also because of the looting by the local residents, the authorities weren't able to determine the actual cause of the crash. However, there was a report that only the co-pilot's body was found in the cockpit, and that led to some speculation that there'd been some disturbance from the passengers and the captain had left the cockpit to deal with it. As a result of this, the U.S. Bureau of Air Commerce issued a directive prohibiting entry into the cockpit of U.S. commercial aircraft at any time during the flight by passengers. So why is this trivia important today, which is the 11th of February, 2014? Well, NC-14274 was the first DC-2 delivered to American Airlines. It was delivered on November the 4th, 1934, and it was featured in the film Bright Eyes, where the star was Shirley Temple, who died today. Interestingly, in that film, she sings her famous song, On the Good Ship Lollipop, while the aircraft supposedly taxiing on the ground. And if you have a look at the video from this, it's really interesting because look through the windows and it seems as though the aircraft is horizontal while taxiing, Well, the DC-2 is a tail dragger. And if any of you have been on a DC-3, you'll remember that during taxiing, the inclination of the floor is quite steep. So, just a piece of trivia for today. Thanks, guys, and thanks for the podcast. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Ray. That's I remember watching Shirley Temple movies, and that one in particular when I was a kid. You, Rob, you must have seen that one as well.
No.
No.
Shirley who?
Oh, God.
Don't call me Shirley.
No, unlike you and I who saw it on television, Max, Rob doesn't want to admit that he saw it on a Saturday matinee with two other movies. And it only cost a nickel.
Mary, you see what I am? Do you see what I'm up against?
It's a disgrace.
No wonder I have to wear that red Speedo thing.
I knew it was coming.
Oh, God, it had to. All right. Well, let's move away from that. And a couple of things real quick. There was an article in Motley Fool. This airline's growth is soaring into the stratosphere. And they talk about Allegiant Air and Spirit Air. And Allegiant, as they note, has gotten pretty good at starting with a low fare and supplementing it with fees that largely go to the bottom line. And that's reflected in their fiscal fourth quarter results, where they see revenue up 7%, which is that's pretty good. But operating income is up over 19%, and similarly, we see Spirit Air that's seen revenue go up 25%, almost 26%. That's the expectation for fourth quarter. That hasn't been announced yet, but earnings per share up almost 66%. And in large part, this is because of fees and things. And it's sort of more data that points to flyers who are seemingly willing to make purchase decisions based on the base fare. And I don't know, people just don't seem to be that concerned about what the total ends up being with all the fees included. So I don't know. Are you guys seeing anything in that area, Mary? Are you seeing anything with ancillary fees and how that affects the purchasing decision?
Yeah, you know, in fact, it's funny. I have some friends that fly Allegiant and Spirit Air regularly. And, you know, they are, because they're regular flyers, they're aware of all the fees. They're fully cognizant of it. They know what to expect. But they're still able to get, more often than not, a better fare on these carriers than the majors. It's really for people who are willing to put up with, you know, the pain of, say, for example, on Spirit, a 28-inch seat pitch for an hour and a half, two-hour flight, maybe down to Florida, that want the convenience, say, of an airport that maybe even closer to them than, you know, for example, I've got a friend who lives in Western Pennsylvania who flies out of La Trobe regularly down to Florida on Spirit Air. And even though she complains endlessly about them, she continues to fly them. So it's one of these things where it's kind of similar to the kind of Ryanair and EasyJet situation in Europe where, you know, there's like endless complaints. But once, you know, once people get used to those, what is still kind of lower fares at the end of the day, even after all those fees are in, they get used to it. That's what they expect.
But, you know, can I throw something in about that? Because I wrote something a couple of weeks ago about Allegiant. And for people that don't know, I'm simply pointing out a fact. I'm not making any kinds of allegations when I say this. But the fellow that runs Allegiant is the fellow that ran ValueJet that went down in Florida. You know, one of their airplanes went down in Florida many years ago. And it eventually merged with, you know, with AirTran and so on and so on. But there's also been quite a bit of publicity on the labor side about the pilots saying that there's an awful lot of safety concerns that management simply does not want to address. And again, I'm not there. I'm simply mentioning what has been reported. And that always scares me when I hear that kind of thing. I think, you know, you can complain about working conditions in the sense of the hours being too long or the pay's not enough or what have you. And people say, yeah, well, okay, whatever. But when they start raising safety concerns, that always gets my attention. You know, I just think that's a factor that we also have to consider. Although, quite honestly, as I said in the story I wrote, there have not been any accidents with, say, Allegiant. They've had a number of engine failures shortly after takeoff, which can be a little exciting for the people in the back if they are not prepared for it, as well as the crew up front. Spirit has a pretty decent safety record, too. In fact, almost an exemplary safety record. But I'm just saying that I think that when you start getting to the cheap, 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 there's going to come a point at which something's going to give, I think. And I'm not saying it's either one of these. It's just that it made me think about it when I was writing that story.
Oh, so. I got to check out this piece. That sounds really interesting. Of course, Allegiant flies rather old fleet, doesn't it? It's got all these MD-80s.
But, you know, that's part of their business strategy, is that they are willing to put up with the excessive fuel flows of these old MD-80s. In fact, I'm sure there's probably some of the MD-80s they're flying or some that we had at Midway about 20-something years ago. But, you know, they are heavy maintenance aircraft, and you just cannot ignore bits and pieces on an airplane like that when it's full of people. And I'm not saying they did. I'm just saying that the labor situation has become a little difficult there at Allegiant, and it always makes you wonder, you know, if there is smoke, is there fire?
Well, again, we're talking with Mary Kirby. How did you first come to think about creating the Runway Girl Network?
Well, I spent 2 years as editor-in-chief of the Apex Media Platform, which included the Airline Passenger Experience magazine, which is a wonderful publication that focused on the passenger experience industries. And during that time, I had the pleasure of working with and commissioning a really sizable amount of journalists. I got to work with many journalists in aviation and, in fact, convinced some classic aviation air transport journalists to check out the passenger experience space, and found that some of them were quite adept at covering the industry. So it was a very fruitful experience to kind of work with these journalists. And during that time, I found that a lot of the women that I was working with were highly reliable and producing incredible copy about passenger experience. And, you know, as I moved in my mind towards the idea that I wanted to get out and strike out on my own and build up my own business, I thought to myself, well, we've got this kind of brand Runway Girl that is recognizable. I've got these fantastic, talented aviation journalists who happen to be women. And it struck me one day, we've got a network of Runway Girls, and let's rebrand, reposition, and come out with a brand new product that really genuinely brings intelligence about the industry. And thus, Runway Girl Network was born.
And so what people can find there is a variety of different things, different articles, different stories, we have the podcast that I've mentioned many times here, the PAXX podcast. Who's the target audience? I mean, who comes to Runway Girl Network to find air transport intelligence?
So it's really interesting. We identify as a B2B2C model. So we're business to business to consumer. So what we're trying to do is attract both businesses and consumers to our site. And we're quite successfully doing that. So Runway Girl Network is a hybrid. It is advertising supported free content, and it is also subscription based premium content. And so the premium content really gets into the weeds of what's going on in the industry, looking at, for example, safety issues, for example, that are occurring in the industry, getting into the weeds of what's happening with these connectivity programs and these aircraft interiors programs, stuff that your general passenger or traveler might not be so interested in, but stuff that is actually affecting market and share prices right now as we speak. So that's the subscription-based part of the site is doing quite well, and so is the free-facing part of the site, where we we provide content that is a little bit more, you could say, traveler or passenger friendly, but still trying to educate the passenger about the systems and services that they are experiencing on board. We believe in transparency. We want more transparency in the industry, and we believe that it's really essential. So I distilled the four categories on the site to passenger safety, passenger comfort, passenger connectivity, and passenger services. And we're really filing a lot of content in all four categories.
Are there some sort of general trends that you see, things that are happening in this space that kind of stick out as the big points for people to think about these days?
Absolutely. And in fact, the trends are part of the reason why I decided to launch the site in the first place, to be completely candid with you. I wanted to strike out on my own because I saw this tsunami, what was occurring in the passenger experience. And I really saw an opportunity, having covered it for many, many years, to develop my own product with these women. So some of the trends that are really impacting what we're doing, obviously, is in-flight connectivity. In-flight connectivity is not just about passenger connectivity. Absolutely, that is becoming the cost of doing business in this industry. The airlines have to get equipped, and even the low-cost carriers, the likes of Ryanair, are talking about getting in-flight Wi-Fi. They know that they're going to have to do it. But it's also about driving operational benefits. And this is the type of stuff, for example, that we would be diving deeper into on the back end of the site. Is connectivity is increasingly going to form the infrastructure of the aircraft. The aircraft are going to be e-enabled. And we're talking about using that connectivity pipe for operational benefits. And that means streaming important information from the aircraft, including ultimately, we're seeing some movement in this regard, black box data. So when you guys were talking about that list of aircraft crashes, I would say that Air France 447, not so long ago, is one that really highlighted the need to have some level of streaming of data down to the ground. And it was a bit shocking that, you know, in modern times, when you have the access to connectivity, that wasn't happening. So these are all things that airlines are pushing forward with. So they will talk kind of a big game about what they're doing for the passenger, but there's method, quote, to their madness in bringing these expensive systems on board. They want to drive operational benefits, and that's, you know, including real-time credit card transactions, predictive analysis, maintenance, having someone waiting at the gate, you know, with a part. I mean, it's, you name it, they're going to do it, and that's really going to underpin the business model for connectivity.
Right, because they have to have a business model, right? I mean, the hardware is not inexpensive, right?
Correct. It is actually quite expensive. Now, it's not to say that airlines haven't gotten some sweetheart deals. Many of them have. The ones especially that jumped in first got great deals on connectivity because they took the leap. So there are some airlines that are kind of kicking themselves and wishing that they hadn't waited so long. But then there are other carriers that are being really cautious and staying on the fences and waiting because there are these new systems coming down the pike that are promising to be much higher bandwidth, offer much better functionality. So there are carriers that are taking this kind of wait and see approach, but they all know that they can't stay on the sidelines for too long. You're not going to be able to be a long haul operator, especially with that offering connectivity here in the not too distant future, or else your stars are going to start dropping.
If I can jump in with something that I know David always says, is that when you're on an airplane, you know, look out the windows, and that makes great entertainment. And
right,
and it does. But yesterday, being in the middle seat, and the person next to me had the shade pulled down, I couldn't look out the window. And it's funny,
poor seat choice.
That's right. In fact, we're going to have a chat about that because my bride did those seats. But anyway, as it was, and I also lost the coin toss, but, you know, on a five-hour flight from San Juan back to O'Hare, I really wanted a little bit of connectivity. I mean, I didn't want to just, you know, play solitaire online with somebody.
You're not a real av geek.
But
surrender your badge. You're no longer an av geek.
Don't hold back, David.
You know my opinion on this subject. You can spend all day long in your life looking at your cell phone and your computer when you're on the ground. If you're in the air, you should be looking out the window because that's the best view in the world.
Well, then you tell this young lady that was sitting next to me, that was asleep, that had the window shade pulled down with her earphones on, that I okay, here's a good one. Mary, I remember on your show a couple of weeks ago when you had Binet on.
I will make a corollary to my
turn.
I will make a corollary to my rule.
Okay.
And that corollary is as follows. You can always look out the window, but if worse comes to worse, you can look at the moving map so you can see where you're going.
Oh, Lord. Dave, don't take away my AvGeek credentials.
And do you know how far I have to admit, I don't know who provides the in-flight connectivity for JetBlue on their map and things. My guess is that it's coming somehow from the DirecTV link or something. I don't know. But
it's actually no. It's the highest capacity Ka-band satellite is providing their in-flight connectivity.
Really?
And this is going to be where Rob says it was off by about 50 miles.
Well, it was off by about 50 miles because that makes me an AV geek, David. Come on. Because as we were coming across the shoreline, or we were within sight of the shore, I looked at where the map said we were, and it showed us over the shoreline. And I said, what a piece of junk. I said, this is not right.
Were you looking at a moving map, or were you yep. using the in-flight connectivity?
No. There is no connectivity on the flight I was on. I know JetBlue has some, but I think it was limited. Certainly it was not on the airplane I was on. I was just looking at that map that you can look on in between TV shows, which I didn't really care about, but it was just amazing to me that it was kind of far off. But okay, I'm sorry. But David, you didn't answer my question because you wouldn't let me finish.
Okay, so go ahead.
Remember, I was saying, Mary, remember when you had Binet on and she was talking about annoying passengers a few weeks ago on your show, and I listened to that, and I really got into it, and I think I sent you guys an annoying passenger consideration. But here's one. What do you do when someone is asleep, and they're sort of asleep against the shade with the shade down, their earphones on, and you're in the middle seat, and you want to look out the window? Should I have just elbowed her in the face and put the shade up, or should I have just taken, you know, the high road and sat back and groaned? What?
You should have gone back to the computer and selected the window seat before you got on the airplane. Then that would not be an issue.
Did I ask you, David? I asked Mary because she understands. No, that's for you, Mary. You understand etiquette better than we do.
Even though David has stripped me of my aviation geek credentials, actually.
No, I did. No, I stripped Rob. I did not strip you of yours. The guest is always right.
But I actually find myself in agreement with David. If you want the window seat, book it in advance, because it really has gotten to that point where there's a certain level of ownership now that passengers have about their space in flight.
But where does it say it's their window?
I know. It's not really, but it is, you know. I mean, you could be very polite. If they weren't asleep, you could be very polite and say, would you mind? But if they're asleep up against that window, I wouldn't dare.
I love the fact that when Mary starts getting sweet like that and talking about interrupting a passenger, her Irish comes out.
Yeah. When I'm sweet.
Okay.
But Mary, seriously, here's a simple question. Who has the best, if I'm going to use connectivity aboard an airplane,
yeah,
who's got the best, in your opinion?
Right this second, the carrier that has the best in-flight connectivity right this second is JetBlue. And they've only got it on 12 aircraft right now, but they're going to start equipping 15 aircraft per month. And the system is, I mean, I've tested virtually all in-flight connectivity systems out there. I've never experienced anything like I did on this JetBlue flight when they launched it. And they brought a bunch of aviation geeks to test it, the likes of John Walton and Jason Rabinowitz, who was just on your show. We really, and Cynthia Drescher from Jaunted, we all put that system through its paces. And there were about 60 of us on board, and we were all streaming. It was true broadband experience. It was pretty amazing. We were, you know, even Skyping in flight and having no problem. So now, when more aircraft are equipped, will be the grand experiment. What it's great to have a fantastic experience, you know, on a handful of aircraft. But what happens when you have 200 or 400 aircraft, which are going to be equipped? So you've got JetBlue that's equipping its entire fleet, and then you've got United that is going to equip 200 Boeing narrow bodies. The Continental Boeing narrow bodies are getting fitted with this same system. So then will, you know, will you get the same level of service? The providers, Viasat and Live TV, claim that you will. So so that's the here and now. But then there are other systems coming down the pike as well that want to give this Fly-Fi, it's called on JetBlue, a run for its money. So Virgin America, late last year in the fall, announced that it's bringing a new ground-to-orbit system, which is a hybrid air-to-ground Ku-band system that Gogo is launching. And they're claiming that they're going to be able to get even better speeds than the Ka. So the race is on, and this is kind of part of the reason why we're having so much fun on the network, and I think in part why we're doing so well, because we have a real understanding of the connectivity market, and we're enjoying writing about it and the competition.
Mary, do you have any sense for how passengers are using their connectivity? Where's the bandwidth going to? Are they streaming videos or movies, or just exactly how are they using the bandwidth that is available?
Well, it's kind of, there's two things going on. It's what passengers want to do and what they're actually able to do. So most of the U.S. fleet is in fact equipped with this air-to-ground system by Gogo. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, Gogo deserves a lot of credit because they started the, I would say, the appetite for in-flight connectivity. They brought what I kind of like to refer to as a cheap and cheerful air-to-ground-based connectivity system to the masses. And it really got people excited about connectivity. And we went from a point where people were complaining about connectivity being on board to now not, you know, they're upset when it's not on board. And I think Gavin Werbeloff said that recently, you know, where it's like now passengers get angry when connectivity isn't there. So Gogo is actually responsible for doing that. And so mad props to them. But as in any competitive market, all these others are popping up and giving them some real competition. And the Gogo system is really capacity constrained. And I think we talked about this maybe a year or two ago, but it really is capacity constrained. You can't stream video. Most passengers get on and they check their email and then they get on social media. So they do some work and they do social media. And social media oftentimes now also is part of work, you know, as you know yourself. So that's how they're using it. Southwest Airlines, in fact, said that Facebook is the number one social media site that passengers go to after checking their email. So that's how passengers are using it. But on JetBlue, because they've got this higher capacity system, they are actually able to offer the ability to stream video on board. And most systems don't allow you to do that. Most airlines throttle you back and don't let you do the high bandwidth functionality. One thing that's distinguishing JetBlue is the ability to do that. So,
Mary, one thing we talked about on a recent PaxX podcast was people using cell phones or VoIP, voice over internet, on the flights. And maybe you can just kind of comment a little bit on where we stand with that and what's happening in that arena.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, while the rest of the world has been bringing in-flight mobile connectivity, which requires a separate type of system, so we're not talking about in-flight Wi-Fi, we're talking about in-flight GSM. It's a different type of system. It requires a picocell on board. It's also pretty expensive, but it allows passengers to seamlessly use their mobile devices on board. And foreign carriers have been offering it. In fact, Virgin Atlantic offers it on its A330s, but they have to shut it down once they are hitting up to U.S. airspace. So about an hour before they land, they shut the system down. Because current regulations here in the U.S., the Federal Communications Commission actually prohibits it still. Now, the FCC realized they couldn't hang on to this kind of antiquated mentality for much longer. It just looked ridiculous in light of what the rest of the world was doing. So they recently proposed, let's just, you know, distinguish the ban, essentially get rid of the ban. And in announcing that prompted a bunch of legislators and the DOT and everyone else to say, well, we don't want voice calls in flight. So the FCC is saying, well, from a technology standpoint, we don't want to prevent you know, airlines from having the choice to bring whether they want mobile connectivity or in-flight Wi-Fi. And then you have the kind of regulators that are saying, well, nobody wants voice calls. And the reality is, and this is the thing that I drive home every opportunity I get, is that mobile connectivity doesn't have to mean voice. Mobile connectivity can mean text messaging or using your mobile for data, as you would on the ground. The systems can the airline can disable voice. And we have every reason to believe that majority of U.S. airlines would disable voice if they were able to bring mobile connectivity systems on board. Most of them have said, most of the majors have said that they wouldn't allow voice. And we can see with the likes of Delta Airlines and these other carriers that have in-flight Wi-Fi, they already disallow voice over IP. They don't allow it. And even JetBlue, that has this high-capacity in-flight connectivity system that can support Skype, one of the few systems out there that's actually able to do it, they've said that they won't allow it, and they're going to shut down voice over IP. So that's where it's at. I think the whole voice debate is a big red herring. I think it's preventing us from moving forward and bringing kind of this next wave of technological development to aircraft. And I think that once all the headlines go away, people will realize this is not such a bad thing. It's not the devil. So that's the long and the short of it.
Good. Maybe you can mention just a little bit quickly about seats these days, right? We've talked about that. Passengers are getting wider and taller, and seats aren't doing the same, certainly.
And in this thing, I will guarantee you, I will agree with everything Barry's about to say.
One of the other big trends, and one of the reasons why Roam My Grill Network is also doing so well, is because we're looking very closely at aircraft interiors and looking at what's happening with seats. And yes, you're absolutely right. Seats are getting physically smaller. They're getting narrower, especially on those 10 abreast 777s, 9 abreast 787s, and likewise at Airbus, they're proposing high density seating configurations on their long haul aircraft as well, despite touting a comfort standard. We won't even go into that. But in any case, they're all proposing and offering these high density configurations. That means that seats are slimmer than they've ever been before. 16.8, 16.9 inches wide on some aircraft. Well, now we all know that people are getting wider and taller, and the seats are getting smaller, and it is one of the great ironies. And you know, a recent report that we published on the network, actually written by Marissa Garcia, finds that actually the seats, we should start looking at this from a safety standpoint, because they're testing these seats with dummies, with those crash test dummies that no longer represent the true passenger size. So, you know, there's all kinds of interesting things happening in the interior space, and we're following it closely. But while these seats have gotten smaller and thinner and tighter and they've squeezed them closer together, they've thrown the technology at us. So here's your in-flight connectivity. Distract while you're in those seats. And so it's all happening together. These trends are definitely commingling.
Mary, I'm going to ask you to let our listeners know where they can find the Runway Girl Network and all the aspects of that, the social media aspects of it as well. But first, just a comment that while there are certainly a lot of really talented women that are part of the network, it's not an exclusive club, right?
No, it's not. It's not. Thanks for the opportunity to explain this. There's two other very important facets of the website. One part of the website is called Lean Into Aviation. We see that as an opportunity to highlight the women that have gone before us and the women in the industry now, highlight their accomplishments. That's Lean Into Aviation, and that is genuinely women writing about other women. We are a network, and we're writing about other women. So that's an important part of the site. It's a part of the site that's doing really, really well. There's also what we call PaxX Forum, and this is a forum for thought leaders in the space, both men and women, to write about the passenger experience, contribute their thoughts and ideas. So we're not exclusive. There's a lot of men, a lot of brilliant men that are now writing for the platform. But the hard news part of the platform is written by women. So it's, you know, I think that when people get to the site and they see it and they see what we're doing, it kind of it starts to make sense. So we're not exclusive. As I say, I love men. What? Yeah. But I do think we have an opportunity. And I think actually it's, you know, as a woman who has gained some level of, I don't even know what the best word would be, notoriety or whatever, in the industry, I kind of feel like I have an obligation, you know, as women. And this is the way we're going to all step up together as a network and really have our voices heard as women in aerospace. We're av fab, David.
And when you look at the lineup of women who are contributors, participants in the network, I see a lot of faces that our listeners would recognize as past guests on the podcast. It's it's a really impressive group.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And of course, there's also the podcast. I'm going to make you tell us something about the podcast for selfish reasons.
The PaxX podcast with my co-host, Max Flight, none other. You know, I really thought it was important to bring this element to the website. I have to say that I have stood in admiration at the Airplane Geeks podcast for many years. And I thought, goodness, you know, I really think that there's a great opportunity to start talking about the passenger experience. And Max was so kind to agree to come on this journey and be the co-host of the PaxX podcast. And it's doing really, really well. And Max, you are a reminder, of course, on the site that we're not exclusive, that we do have have some men. And you're doing very well, by the way. You're doing wonderfully with passenger experience.
I never thought I would be representing or one of the representatives of my gender as part of a minority. I know, but here it is.
Do you care how the men are dressed, Mary?
Not at all. No, we're kind of a judgment free zone. That's one of the great things about the Runway Girl Network. We're a real judgment free zone. You know, for sure. I think women have a voice, and I think it's great to bring that voice. And as represented by, you know, the fact that this incident occurred recently, the Knock Air at Singapore Airlines, I do think women have a way to go. There's not enough C-level women executives in the industry. There's definitely not enough women sitting on the board of directors. There are a lot of women in public relations. And actually, the airport side of the equation has a lot of women executives. But outside of that, aerospace is kind of, it's a bit of a dearth. So we're trying to change that and hope to do our little part.
Mary, you reported on kind of some movement from, of all places, Saudi Arabia in terms of women in aviation.
Correct. I was really impressed to see this actually over the weekend, and I saw the opportunity to write about it. FlyNAS in Saudi Arabia has signed on as an aviation sponsor of a career fair for women. Saudi Arabia is trying to move away from an oil-based economy, and they realize that they're going to need women to do that, and they need women in the workforce. And so they're really making a big push to try and bring women into the workforce and to empower women to a certain degree. Now, its change is going to be slow. But really, whenever we see any kind of level of positive change occurring for women anywhere in the world, we want to promote it. And so I did write a piece about that. And the company that is behind this career fair, it's called Glowwork. And I just connected with the CEO on Facebook. And I'm hopeful that we might be able to do some more coverage of what they're doing in Saudi Arabia. But props to FlyNAS for promoting this.
Excellent. All right. Well, the website is runwaygirlnetwork.com.
Correct.
And Mary, you still tweet as Runway Girl.
Correct. Runway Girl at Runway Girl represents the network. So, you know, we're pushing all the content. And also, of course, I'm engaging in my regular social media chats, which I love. So people can find us on Twitter, find us on the website, find us on Facebook, Google+. We're on pretty much everything. Pinterest.
Very good. All right. Well, again, Mary, thanks so much for coming back and joining us. We really look forward to every visit that you make with us. I know especially Rob does.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a pilot. I'm expected to be a little shallow. Okay.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I'm just living down to my.
Rob, you want to see more women in aviation, don't you?
Oh, sure. You know what? It's really funny, but I remember saying to somebody, oh, this is 20-some years ago when I had some lady students. I said, you know, guys, I have to tell you, the women are better students than the guys are. And they said, oh, you can't, how can you say it? But you know what? The women didn't get their egos all wrapped up in learning to fly. If they made a mistake, they went, oh, okay. And then they just fixed it and moved on. Where the guys were all, you know, defensive and emotional, and it was just, it was crazy. But so I rather would have enjoyed teaching more ladies. I just wish there were more out there trying to learn to fly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there was a report this morning that I just saw that I saw on Twitter that said, and I retweeted this. Where helicopter pilots, female helicopter pilots, are doing awfully well. I believe it's Time Magazine that has a piece on they're saying that the women are proving to be better helicopter pilots.
Huh,
and it's not. And I want to stress this. This is not a he versus she. This is a it's time to welcome the she more into aerospace.
Yes.
You know, we're not battling it out. It is there's no battle of the sexes on Runway Girl Network. It's all about we want to be included in aviation.
Yeah, I think you should.
Thanks.
All right. Again, Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And now here's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association to tell us what to expect on the next NBAA Flight Plan podcast. Take it away, Pete.
So why is it a good idea to subscribe to NBAA's air traffic services? Well, there's an app for that. I'm Pete Combs. Details coming up this week at NBAA.org.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian, with the Aircraft of the Week.
Thanks, Max. The Airplane Geeks Airplane of the Week. The Boeing 247, the plane that built the DC-3. I'd like to thank a friend of the show, Henry Hardeveld, for selecting tonight's aircraft. He tweeted a picture of one of four surviving ones from Av Geek Fest in 2014. And it sounds like everybody out there in Washington had a good time this weekend. The Boeing 247 was a radical departure from the current airliners. The Curtiss T-32 Condor II was purchased by Eastern Air Transport and American Airways. United Airlines wanted a better aircraft and purchased the aircraft off the drawing board. Its pilots would have serious input in its design, and that would somewhat hinder it. The 247 was a semi-monocoque low-wing monoplane. The wing was a fully cantilevered wing. A cantilevered wing has all of its supports internal to the wing. Usually it's a large spar. This will become an issue later with the airplane. This is different from the cable stays of the biplanes of the day, like its competitor, the Curtiss Condor II. From the wings were to have hung 700 horsepower Pratt & Whitney R1690 Hornets.
Yay!
This was quickly rejected because the United Airlines pilots' opinion on the additional weight would make the airplane impossible to land because everyone knows that no airport at the time could handle an 8-ton airplane. This does explain why United doesn't fly A380s at 630 tons maximum takeoff weight. The other issue was the Hornets were too hot for the airplane pilots to fly during the day. The engine issue would cause a rift between Pratt & Whitney chief engineer George Meade and then President Frederick Rentschler, who went with United's decision to downgrade the engines to the S1H1G Wasp with 560 horsepower. Meade felt this was a real step looking backwards and would cause issues in later successes on the airframe, and he was right. With the engine reduction came a reduction in passengers. The original plan was for 14 passengers. The 247E came out with seating for 10. This would be another tactical error caused by the United pilots. In this case, for Boeing, the customer wasn't always right. The 247 was still a radical airplane. It first flew on February 8, 1933, with its introduction in service of May 1933 with Boeing Air Transport. The first thing you noticed that was different would be the forward swept windscreen. The design was so that lit instruments would not flare onto the windscreen at night. As it turned out, the glare off the ground in daylight was worse. It also added severe drag to the airplane.
The windscreen was reversed to a normal style, and eventually a glare shield added over the instruments solved the problem. The 247 was the first airliner fitted with the ICER boots. It had retractable landing gear. It also had a rudimentary autopilot. All the control surfaces had trim tabs. What made the 247 so special was it could also fly with one engine out, a first. Its cruise speeds were 188 miles an hour with a range of 745 miles. Boeing Air Transport flew a 247 across the country in 19 and a half hours from San Francisco to Newark. A record. Passengers now could fly across the country without changing planes or having to overnight. In 1934, the Boeing Company, because of the aircraft, was awarded the Collier Trophy. A 247D, a modified 247 with Hamilton standard variable speed props, gave the aircraft 7 miles per hour more speed. The aircraft also had its cabin stripped of seats and replaced with 8 fuel tanks. With Racer 57, as the aircraft was called, Colonel Roscoe Turner and his co-pilot Clyde Pangborn completed the Mac Robinson race. The Mac Robinson was for $75,000 prize for someone who could fly from London to Melbourne for kangaroo steaks. Okay, I made up the part about the steaks, not the prize. The team took 92 hours and 55 minutes, coming in third overall and second in the transport class, which was won by a DC-2. November Romeo 257 Yankee survived and now hangs at the National Air and Space Museum downtown in D.C. On her left side is her markings as she flew the race. On her right, her United Airlines markings when she returned back to being an airliner, November Charlie 13369er. One other notable interesting event, and this follows along with our most interesting crashes, was the mid-air explosion of November Charlie 13304. Flying from Cleveland to Chicago on October 10, 1933. The pilot, co-pilot, a flight attendant, and 4 passengers died when the plane exploded in mid-flight. The investigation showed that a probable cause was nitroglycerin in a brown package wrapped in a suitcase placed on the airplane. This is the first proven act of sabotage in commercial aviation history. The 247 airliners became the C-73 transports during the war. 27 with the United States Army Air Forces, 121 Squadron of the Royal Canadian Air Force operated 7. One 247Y was purchased by Chiang Kai-shek as his personal transport. It featured a hatch atop with a flexible mount for a Colt 50 caliber machine gun for self-protection. Eventually, all the survivors after the war became business aviation planes or hauling cargo. Besides the 247D at the National Air and Space Museum, Charlie Foxtrot Juliet Romeo Quebec resides in the Canadian Aviation Museum. November 13347 is being restored at Washington at the Museum of Flight, and that's the one that was pictured by Henry. The only other airworthy survivor, and is last, is N18 Echo, which is at the National Museum of Science and Industry in the United Kingdom. So I titled this segment, The Aircraft That Built the DC-3. Why? TWA wanted the Boeing 247s as soon as possible, but Boeing would not sell the aircraft until it produced United, and there, Boeing Air Transports contracted 60. So Trans Western Airways, went looking for a new tri-motor. What came out of that was by Douglas was the Douglas Commercial 1, otherwise known as the DC-1. The DC-1 would fly in July after the 247 and would have 12 passengers, and TWA would encourage Douglas to add 2 more seats, making it the DC-2 and bringing those seats up to 14, the original total amount for the Boeing 247. Also, the DC-1 did not have that annoying spar in the center of the cabin that you needed to step over, which was another problem with the 247. By 1934, it was clear that the DC-2 was a superior aircraft. Of course, it would be the one that would beat the 247D in the Mac Robertson race. Eventually, C.R. Smith wanted to replace his Condor 2s, the aircraft the 247 was designed to replace, and convinced Douglas to produce the Douglas Sleeper Transport, or DST. Which everyone knows became the greatest aircraft transport of all time, the DC-3. And that is how Boeing and United created the DC-3, but not by choice. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your airplane geeks historian, signing off.
Wow, that's really fascinating. That's some interesting history. Did they ever figure out who put the nitroglycerin on the plane?
No, it was never solved. They know it was an explosive. Supposedly they saw someone put something in the luggage hold, but it was never, they could never prove who it was. But it is the first, literally a bomb went off in the airplane at altitude.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 17th of February, 2014.
2014. It's still hard to get used to saying that, I reckon. But welcome, folks, to the Australia Desk for episode 287. Grant, how are you? Sound a bit tired, mate.
It's been a bit of a long day. Lots going on with the day job. Plus, I was up pretty late the night before, getting a few things sorted out for Plane Crazy.
It's good to see you working for the company, mate. Working for a good cause.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, well, we've got something a little bit different on the segment this week. We're going to interview someone who produces another wonderful blog down here in this part of the world, and that's Mike Yeo, and he produces a blog called thebaseleg.com. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve and Grant. It's good to talk to you guys.
Now, Mike, you're a Singaporean, I think, originally, but you're based down here in Melbourne these days, and I tell you what, with the Baseleg blog, you get out and, you know, we often think we do some pretty cool things and get some great photography, but you have some fantastic access yourself.
Yes, I tried to get around.
Well, looking at the latest one, which is the Chinook, that's pretty good, getting on board one of those. They're a beast of a machine, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Loud, noisy, and the vibration when you're flying on board is just another thing. And with the Singaporean Air Force, it was a bonus to get on board one of their helicopters because, in case you didn't realize, they're actually a very pretty secretive organization and they're very tight on security. So to be able to get a chance to get on board was quite cool, you might say.
Now, you talk about that Chinook there that's actually featured on the top of your blog at the moment at thebaseleg.com. Singaporean Air Force, there's a reason for that because you've just been over at the Singapore Air Show.
Yes, that's right. I spent the last week over at the Singapore Air Show, which is an air show that's held every 2 years in Singapore, just off the famous Changi International Airport.
Okay, now tell us a bit about that air show, Mike. You know, we'd love to get over there. In fact, obviously one of the bigger air shows in this region of the world.
Yes, the Singapore Air Show was definitely one of the bigger air shows in this region. For example, this year, the organizers had announced that there were $32 billion worth of commercial sales that were racked up over the trade days that were held between the 11th and the 14th of February.
Puts it right up there with the big ones of Farnborough and, of course, Le Bourget, and not to be moved out by the Middle Eastern show at Dubai.
Dubai, yeah.
So yeah, that's some serious money changing hands.
Oh yes, but the show mainly focuses on the commercial side of things and less of the military. Even though there is a undercurrent of insecurity in the region these days.
So that's interesting in itself. I know with our experience looking at Avalon, I guess is the one that we're most familiar with here, there seems to be an increasing influence of military on that air show. But interesting that you're saying that, you know, there's more of a commercial influence with the Singapore air show. I guess there's been a lot of growth in the, you know, basically the civilian airliner market in that part of the world. So I guess that really shows through in this air show.
Yes, and I guess because most militaries, they tend not to want to do their business out at an air show like this. They prefer to do their deals off-site, but there's definitely a lot of military interest looking at the equipment, looking at the whatever products on display at the show.
Yeah, look and do the deals offline later.
Yeah, that's right.
So which would be of some of the bigger deals and bigger operators that you saw there, was there anything that really sort of stuck out to you in this air show?
Yeah, at the air show this time, as I was just telling Steve earlier, there are three military aerobatic display teams from around the region. It made quite an impact on this show because it's not very often that we get three display teams coming to one show in the region. We had the Black Knights from Singapore flying their F-16s, and we also had the Black Eagles from South Korea with their T-50 trainers, and the Indonesian Jupiter team were also there flying their KT-1 trainers. It was great to see the teams performing. The problem was the weather didn't quite cooperate during the days I was there. It was pretty hazy and made photography very difficult.
Obviously, this is a segment about this part of the world and, you know, here in Australia, so we want to obviously see if there was any Australian participation in the Singapore Air Show. The Royal Australian Air Force, you were telling us off air, had a brief display.
Yes, they had a pair of Super Hornets down from Amberley, and one of them would take part in the daily area display, but there were no RAF aircraft up on display on the static display.
No static display. It's interesting, isn't it? I often think when we go to places like Avalon, you can bring your cameras out, but if you start walking behind those aircraft with your cameras, the RAF security people are usually a little bit anxious about that. So I'm just wondering, I wonder if that's why they didn't land those planes. Maybe there's, you know, as you said, there's a lot of conflict in the region. Maybe they don't want to be showing those planes off too closely to people.
Yes. Yeah, we made, there were quite a few jokes about the relatively large mainland Chinese presence at the show, so that we were joking that they probably couldn't be allowed to take too many photos of the top secret inlets on the Super Hornets.
There you go. Well, that's interesting in itself, Mike. What sort of aircraft were the Chinese showing off? I mean, you know, as with everything else, they're trying to establish themselves as an aircraft manufacturing nation. You know, they manufacture everything else, so why not aircraft? Were they, you know, trying to promote their brands of aircraft?
Yeah, that was actually one of the big talking points of Chinese. They were supposed to bring down their aerobatics display team the August 1st with the J-10 fighter to the show. And they were supposed to be performing at the area display as well, but for some reason it was cancelled at the last minute and they just didn't turn up. No one knows for sure why. There were the usual speculation and gossip, but no one could really pin down a real reason why the Chinese didn't show up.
Interesting. But there was quite a few of them there on the ground, walking around looking at everyone else, right?
Yes, that's right. And the Chinese companies had quite a big presence there in terms of the booth in the exhibition area. They had their various aerospace companies displaying their products at the show, but there were actually no airframes there.
So lots of models and lots of brochures and lots of talking, but no real aircraft that you could go up and kick the tires, so to speak.
Yeah, no, not this time.
Okay. Now, Singapore, of course, being a major, with Changi being a major hub. You've got Singapore Airlines, of course, with Scoot and Silk Air. Who else was there on the airline front?
Well, Qatar brought one of their new Boeing 787s and put them on a static display. And Airbus actually brought in one of the A350s to do static and flying displays. I think it was MSN-03 that was on the ground.
How did the A350 look against the 787?
Oh, it's definitely bigger than the 787. But the thing that jumped up at you in the flying display segment was that it is really quiet, even while watching from the ground.
Even quieter than the 787? Did they have that on display, on flying display?
No, just the A350 this time.
Okay. Yeah. Nice to know it's quiet. Because, yeah, I think the A350 is more the -9, -10 kind of size for the 787.
Yes, that's correct.
No, well, I'm sure we'll look forward to seeing a few of those in our skies in future years.
Well, we're going to have a -9 pretty soon, later this year or at the latest early next year with Air New Zealand, but they're likely to bypass Melbourne with them and go Auckland to Perth, I believe. But the general rule of thumb is that the -9 is probably the 787 that Boeing wanted to have from the start. They've learnt a lot from the -8, you know.
Well, Mike, thanks for joining us on the show tonight. Once again, folks, you can check out Mike's fantastic blog there at thebaseleg.com. We'll put a link in the show notes for this week's episode. Mike, what's the next project for you? I know you've just had a whirlwind trip to Singapore and back, but what's the next adventure for you aviation-wise?
I'm actually looking forward to the RAF Centenary of Aviation over at Point Cook in early March. I'm not quite sure if I'm still going. Unfortunately, the day job's been keeping me busy.
There's a common theme.
Yeah, I can sympathise with that, mate.
Yes, we're both heading off to that one, so we'll have to make sure if you are there that we catch up with you.
Oh, yes, definitely.
No worries. Mike, thanks for joining us here on the Australia Desk.
All right, nice talking to you guys.
Thanks, Grant. Thank you. That's everything we have for you on this week's edition. I guess we'll wrap it up there and we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Mike Hill.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
All right. Thanks, guys. Boy, Singapore. I love Singapore, having spent many, many, many days there over the years. And even attending the Singapore Air Show once. I think if I was going to pick one major air show in the world to attend, I think it might be Singapore. It's a great place.
That's
great
interesting. Show. I've never been there. In fact, I was just talking to a friend of mine over in France today that was over there at the Singapore show and And he just raved about it and how interesting it was, how busy it was.
Yeah.
And I said, well, maybe one of these days before I get really old, I'm going to go over there.
Yeah, I recommend it's a good vacation spot, too. I mean, there's so many things to do and see, and the people are fantastic, and the food is great. It's very multicultural with, you know, a variety of different groups represented, different ethnic groups. And so that contributes to the sort of variety of the food as well. So, yeah, and the air show is great. It's a nice size. I mean, it's big, but it's not gigantic and off-putting because of that. All right, now we have a new segment from Rob. This is called the Aviation Minute. Rob, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Thanks, Max. Well, I think the point of the Aviation Minute is to consider one opinion on one topic and to give someone 60 or 90 seconds worth of it and give them something to think about related to that one topic. So here we go with episode one of the Aviation Minute. I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. There's been quite a bit of talk lately about the pilot shortage, and the opinions don't seem to be mixed. Either it's almost here, or, well, it's not going to happen at all. Last week's Wall Street Journal called it a shortage, while the Airline Pilots Association said just the opposite. So who's really right? In most cases, a shortage means jobs are plentiful and wages are high. But at the regional airlines, pay is still lousy, and at the majors, well, they only snap their fingers and they find pilots in a minute. But the regionals really are where the shortage is coming, and soon. Because furloughed pilots, like those from Comair, for instance, are not willing to start all over again at another poor-paying regional airline. New pilot starts are down, too, because meeting the 1,500-hour rule makes learning to fly much more expensive. The majors are going to have to step in, but don't watch for any huge salary increases. The carrot they're going to use, it's going to be a seniority number at the mainline. American Airlines has made a seniority number at the mainline part of the new Eagle contract, too. If the pilots will just sign it, of course. Continental's tried it, and even Delta has a few agreements to bring regional pilots onto the mainline. So will the seniority carrot work? Only time will tell. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark.
So thanks for that, Rob. We look forward to an Aviation Minute in each episode coming up for at least as long as you have opinions.
Well, that's true. So we'll see how long that holds out.
All right. Moving now to listener mail. We talked last episode in 286 about the aviation museums. We had a list of the world's best aviation museums. I think we got that from CNN. And we asked listeners to send in their thoughts if they had other museums that should have made the list or that they wanted to comment on. And we received quite a number of those. We heard from Paul Filmer, one of our favorite aviation photographers. And we had, when we were talking about the Central Museum of the Air Forces in Menino, I think it was you, David, that maybe speculated that Paul probably had visited that. And he writes to us and said, how did you guess that I've been to Menino? He says, I'm not into museums generally, but Menino is simply superb. Most of the exhibits are outside, and there are many aircraft displayed, both officially and stored in the grass area at the rear. He says everything from airliners, bombers, fighters, helicopters, and the weird one-off aircraft from the Cold War days. He says, I generally don't process photos from museums, but I did some quick and dirty edits so you can see a few aircraft. And he sent along some photos, and we'll put maybe a couple of these in the show notes. And so be sure to take a look at those at airplanegeeks.com. And also, if you want to see more of Paul's work, you can find that at skippyscage.com. And then Ryan wrote in and said, on that list of museums, I am surprised the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum did not get a mention, as they have aircraft ranging from a Pitts Special to the Spruce Goose. Also, the Royal Air Force Museum in Cosford in the UK. They have a hangar full of prototypes and other experimental aircraft, Cold War hangar, etc. And that's from Ryan. Thank you, Ryan.
Now, should I take umbrage at Ryan that I did mention the RAF Museum in London in last week's episode or no?
Yeah, no, don't mention that.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that in.
Oh, I know you are.
Andrew wrote in, just listened to episode 286 and had some feedback regarding the top 14 museums discussion. He says, I visited number 12, the Royal Flying Doctor Service Museum in Alice Springs, Australia. And he says, this is a great museum and would recommend it to anyone visiting Central Australia. You can learn about the history of the Royal Flying Doctor Service and how they operate, providing medical service to remote communities and outback stations. They have a Pilatus PC-12 on display, showing how it is set up with stretchers and medical equipment. He says, I also thought I'd share some of my own museum visits. Last year, I studied on exchange at a university at Linköping, Sweden, for a semester, Linköping being home of Saab. Here they have the Swedish Air Force Museum, a truly fantastic museum and home to many different Saab aircraft. The highlight for me was the prototype Gripen aircraft on display, an awesome machine to see up close. They also have many great displays for each decade in history and Sweden's involvement in the various conflicts over time and several simulators, including a Gripen simulator. And he says there is also the Aeroseum in Gothenburg. I've been to Gothenburg once. There's another place I visited and didn't know there was a museum. He says, which is located inside an underground hangar. This is pretty fascinating. An underground hangar at the military airport there. The hangar is 30 meters underground and was built during the Cold War to protect the Swedish Air Force F-9 fleet. One enters through a tunnel whose entrance can be covered with thick curtains designed to protect the aircraft inside from the shock waves of an explosion. Inside, they have many Saab aircraft on display as well as exhibits on the Cold War. It is also where many aircraft are currently undergoing restoration. You can see people working on the planes during your visit. It's very hands-on. Visitors are encouraged to climb inside the cockpits and around many of the planes and helicopters on display. They have several simulators for fighters and prop planes. Very cool museum. Love the show. Keep up the great work. Cheers. That's from Andrew in Sydney, Australia.
Luciana wrote from us, we have a very nice museum here in Brazil. It's a private one belonging to TAM Airlines, located in San Carlos Airport, about 160 miles from São Paulo. I've already been there twice. It's always been a good excuse for some cross-country flying. I'm a private pilot and a member of the São Paulo Flying Club. Among all the aircrafts displayed there, my preferred one for sure is the Lockheed Constellation.
Oh, my favorite.
Good choice.
Yes.
Good choice. And we'll put some links in the show notes. And actually, it's the TAM Museum. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, you can't go wrong with the world's largest tri-motor.
Sure. You want to take the next one, or Rob?
No, I can do it. That's the one from Kent, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It says, hi, geeks. This is from Kent in Fairfax, Virginia. And he said, I just got through listening to episode 286. With respect to the list of good aviation museums, I suggest the National Naval Aviation Museum at NAS Pensacola. I didn't know the Navy had museums. I thought it was just the cool Air Force guys.
Well,
okay, I guess I'm giving away my heritage. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, the NAS Pensacola, they have an enormous collection of Naval and Marine Corps airplanes, and my personal favorites were the Sopwith Camel, assembled from spare parts, complete with Snoopy in the cockpit. I'd like to see that. A Presidential Marine One helicopter, and a Curtiss NC-4, the huge flying boat biplane. Kent said that last summer my son and I stayed in the beachfront campground on the base and watched naval aviator trainees flying overhead until we fell asleep to the sound of jet engines. Fortunately, they weren't too loud to sleep, he said. We spent the next day in the museum, and my son, who never cared about airplanes until that trip, enjoyed the camping and the airplanes so much that this year we're going to EAA Air Venture, and then he says, we hope to see you there. And
oh, for sure.
You'll certainly see me there at some point. We thank you for that. And should I go on and read the next one from Justin?
Sure. Go ahead, Rob.
Well, heck, Justin, he says, hi, geeks. First, thanks to all of you for the work you put in on the podcast. Thank you. It's nice to hear that. We all appreciate that. I appreciate being able to immerse myself in all things aviation when stuck in sometimes seemingly endless traffic on my way to and from work. I'd like to add a museum to the list presented in your latest episode, and that's the aviationmuseum.com in Australia. It is actually better known as the Temora Aviation Museum in the state of New South Wales in Australia, which I'm sure Steve and Grant know where that is. The aim there is to keep all the aircraft in the collection in flying condition, which is no small challenge, I would imagine, and they have an amazing collection. The museum also hosts flying days every second Saturday, where they have an air
Sunday.
Show. I'm sorry, you're right. Thank you. I was just testing you guys.
Okay, we're listening.
The museum also hosts flying days every second Sunday, where they have an air show where the exhibits we've flown. Many times I've taken the Duchess out from Bankstown Airport in Sydney in the early morning and spent the day out there. Spend the day eating barbecue, watching the show, and then I fly home once the show's over. It's always great fun. Thanks again for the great show and safe skies, and thank you for that, Justin. Very nice. And I'm impressed that you fly a Beach Duchess.
Yeah, very good. All right. Well, we may get some more feedback from you all on the aviation museums that are exciting to you or that you've visited. And so I guess we'll just kind of keep this rolling because they're interesting comments, interesting information about these. And, you know, we really should support the aviation museums that are around us in whatever way we can.
My two comments are this. One, at some point, Max, we need to make a field trip, and I'll meet you halfway and do Rhinebeck, which is probably
yes.
one of the greatest collection of 30s and World War I replicas and restorations in the world. And the other one is, my challenge for all of you listeners out there is, tell me where there's a flying museum on the African continent. Maybe South Africa has an Air Force Museum or something. I'm just curious. We've hit Latin America. We've hit Europe. We've hit Australia. We've hit Asia, but nothing on the African continent. So I'm curious what's out there for that.
Very good. Okay. We also heard from Rich. He says, hello, airplane geeks. Thank you for the very informative and fun shows. I especially enjoyed your recent show, which featured the round-the-world flight of the Mitsubishi MU-2. It reminded me of the time when I first spotted one of these fantastic aircraft at El Monte Airport in Southern California. I'll always remember the distinct sound of those turboprops on run-up before takeoff. Thanks again for the great work. And he sent along a nice photo, a really nice photo. Good prop blur on this photo. It looks really, really nice. And we'll put that in the show notes. So thanks for that. We heard from Mike. Mike sent us an article in AIN Online, new ice detection system coming. And this comes from an announcement at the Singapore Air Show. And it says current in-flight icing detection systems, or FIDS. FIDS. Do you call them FIDS, Rob?
I actually never heard it called that until I saw this.
Okay. Well, he said the FIDS currently cannot detect ice crystals, but this company, Zodiac Aerospace, is developing something new that uses optical techniques. And reportedly, it can detect any form of icing and will be able to tell you whether it's a small or large supercooled droplets, crystals, and so forth, whatever's impacting the airplane. And it'll give specific warnings to the crew when large droplet icing conditions or ice crystals are encountered. So, Rob, have you ever had an icing situation in your flying?
Certainly, I've been in situations where I've had ice. Of course, to me, ice is only something you should see for a short period of time as you're passing, climbing through a layer of clouds or descending down through it. But you don't want to be in level flight picking up ice because it does not take much to get to a point where you can run out of performance with the engines in order to keep the airplane in the air.
Yeah, it really degrades the aerodynamics of the wing.
Oh,
right?
God, yeah. It can seriously do that. And I often think that sometimes people don't have enough respect for ice, even in little airplanes. People out in single-engine airplanes get it, and they think it's pretty cool. Not to me.
No.
I don't know. After this winter, I have a lot of respect for ice, and I would like to respectfully to disappear.
Oh, yeah, especially Rob in Chicago. You know what? I heard a reference to the weather. I know we're not supposed to talk about weather. The weather in Chicago. Somebody was referring to Chicago as Chiberia.
Not bad. I had not heard that, but I think this winter has certainly not been fun. But as I said to David today in an email, I said, you folks out on the East Coast have really been beaten up quite a bit as well. In fact, really, let's be serious. Every place east of the Rockies here in the United States has had a pretty tough winter.
It's been brutal. But the only thing, you know, it keeps you inside. You can't do a lot of things. But the only thing you can do inside is, you know, watch movies or something. And in fact, David, a different David, sent us an email, and he said that there's this movie, Charlie Victor Romeo. And it's a documentary that's derived from black box transcripts from six airline emergencies. And David says he saw this last night at Film Forum. Pretty good as long as disaster stories don't bring you down. I recommend it if it is released somewhere else one day. It was also performed live in the late 90s, I believe, he says. Saw it in Manhattan then also. We have a link to this. And Rob, Scott Spangler wrote about this recently on Jetwine, didn't he?
He did, actually. And so it was really kind of a coincidence that it all seemed to come back together again. But it's amazing how many times people find unique ways of telling stories about our industry. And so I really enjoyed this.
So we'll put the links to the movie page. It's a IMDb page, and also Scott Spangler's piece in Jetwine.
Thank you.
And let's see. Oh, we heard from Pasadena Brian. He says he sent along a link to an article, reports detail pilots heading to wrong airports. And I guess the Associated Press did a search. They searched government safety data and news reports since the early 1990s. And what they found were at least 150 cases where U.S. commercial passenger and cargo planes either landed at the wrong airport or started to land at the wrong airport and then realized they were making a mistake in time. And as I said, 150 flights. Now, they also note that that's what's kind of in the record, and there may be more because not every incident is disclosed to the media. But it sounds like a big number, 150 flights. I guess some airports are maybe represented more than others in the historic data. But this sort of thing does happen not infrequently. Bob Iverson sent us a story from the Wall Street Journal. This is, what can a new pilot make? Question. Answer, near minimum wage. There's an interesting infographic, I guess you call this. I don't know when charts became infographics, but I guess that's what we call them now. Job trajectory. It shows the average first-year base salary and the average fifth-year base salary for a number of different occupations. Co-pilot at a regional, co-pilot at a major, flight attendants at regionals and majors, and mechanics. And I guess we've seen these kinds of numbers before, but it just sort of hits home with the picture. Regional co-pilots starting at average $22,400, and even after 5 years at the regional, $35,100. This is U.S. dollars. Co-pilots at a major airline starting just over $50,000, significantly more than the regional, and after 5 years, just a little over $100,000. Flight attendants at regional and major airlines, not as much distinction. Starting salary for flight attendants at a regional, $16,250. At a major, $19,528. And then after 5 years at a regional, just under $25,000. And at a major, just over $32,000. Mechanics earn more typically than flight attendants. Not as much as pilots at majors, more than co-pilots at regionals, with mechanics starting at around $37,300 and after 5 years at $49,400.
Well, my question is, why weren't captains added to this list?
Maybe, I don't know. Rob, you think it's because the numbers would be so shocking that compared to the others?
Probably. I think that you'd probably find that some of the guys at Comair, which is the regional carrier that Delta put out of business a few years ago. I mean, a senior captain at Comair on the RJs was probably, he was probably close to $100,000, I'll bet. You know, $90,000, I'm sure. But then a captain at a major airline, I mean, one of the best paid airlines, of course, is Southwest. Those guys are making quite a bit more here than the $101,000 mentioned. But it takes a while. And you know, that's kind of what prompted me to start out the first Aviation Minute with the discussion about pilot shortage, because it's not as easy as just saying, well, here are the numbers and these guys make this amount and this, you know, there's a little more political and business strategy behind all this. And again, the regionals are never going to be the career that the major airlines will be. It doesn't matter. It's just never going to happen.
And by chance, finally, Dima sent in a link to an article in the Flying Magazine, ALPA's Message for Aspiring Aviators. The looming pilot shortage is a myth. And so we'll put the link to that in the show notes, but that's sort of apropos with Rob's minute that we heard earlier. So thanks to Dima for sending that in. All right, I think that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank Mary Kirby for being our guest this episode. You can find her new network at runwaygirlnetwork.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at runwaygirl. We want to thank our contributors, Grant McHaren, Steve Vischer, plaincrazydownunder.com. And let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. David, we'll start with you. Where can folks find more Vanderhoof?
That would be British Columbia, Canada.
We've heard that before.
Well, sorry, that's the best answer to give you. No, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Google Plus. Look for the Airplane Geeks on Google Plus, Facebook, and Twitter. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with Max Flight on the UAV Digest podcast.
And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, people can find me at jetwine.com, which is where our blog is, which will also be running some bits from Aviation Minute. Les will be having it here on the Airplane Geeks, also Jetwine on Twitter. And for those people that are aviation safety geeks, you can read what we're doing at AIN Safety, which is at AIN Magazine, AINonline.com. And there's always some good safety topics there if you're interested.
Very good. Thank you, Rob. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Google Plus and Twitter. Just look for Max Flight, as David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com, where we have our podcast, and also at the RunwayGirlNetwork.com, where you can find the PaxX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes for this episode at AirplaneGeeks.com. If you'd like to use the shortcut, the fast method, you can go to AirplaneGeeks.com/287 for episode 287. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also, we have a Google Plus community. And also, you can find us on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone or other device. And you can also find us on TuneIn.com. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And if you'd like to talk a message to us, speak a message to us, we have a listener line.
Where talk you can, a message to us?
Yeah, I know.
She wants to talk a message to us. Yeah, okay. I'm
sorry. I guess I've been doing this too long. Aunt Benet Wilson, the aviation queen, will tell us something about that.
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEK-01.
Thank you, Aunt Benet. You know, Aunt Benet is one of the writers over at the Runway Girl Network also. Thanks, Benet. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Good night, everybody.
Hi, Mary. I'm still in love with you. I hope that's okay. I didn't tell anybody. Except these guys. Anyway, but I had to get that out. Okay.
Aw, can we talk about your red Speedo again? No? Probably not.
Okay, gotta go.
All right. Before we move on, anybody have any other newsy kinds of items to bring up?
Well, let's see. I already said it's only 33 days till spring, right?
So that's,
You know, Mary, did we want to, what do you think? Should we have pictures of me and the Speedo thing, do you think? Or should
no,
we just
You don't actually have any of those, do you? Because I could put them in the show notes. We could make them, you know, the lead photo for this episode.
No. Yeah, on second thought, I think.
Oh, Lord.
No, I think basically you need to take the picture and then put black bars across his face so that everyone knows who it
is. And no one will know it's me, right?
Oh, my.
Do you actually have one? Just remind
me. I don't even know what a red Speedo is. I mean, I kind of know, but not completely.
Okay, quit being an ass and get on with it.
And we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
Oh, I was going to say, and this is where Mike gets going. I'm Mike Yo.
Oh, yeah, geez.
3, 2, 1, go for it, Mike.
And I'm Mike Yo.
Yeah, lovely. I can splice that in.
Sweet.
Hey, I can make something out of that.
You can hack that together, mate.
this sort of thing does happen not infrequently.
Yep.
Rob's never landed at the wrong airport.
No. Oh, I didn't realize that was a question. I thought you were making a statement, actually.
No, it was supposed to be a leading statement, you know.
Yeah, it was an implied statement.
Then you better do it to me again, because
let's just skip it, move on.